Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
It's absolutely imperative that the Division of Elections, the Lieutenant Governor, learn some powerful lessons from the outcome of this.
Why so many ballots from rural Alaska were rejected in the special primary election. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 29th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Democratic House candidate Mary Peltola has a reputation for being nice.
And I think with Mary Peltola, you should never, ever misconstrue kindness for somebody who's not going to stand up for what she believes in.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Former President Donald Trump is coming to Alaska to campaign for 3 Republican candidates running for statewide office. The visit was announced in a statement today from Save America, a political action group founded by Trump after his loss in the 2020 election. The group says Trump will hold a rally Saturday, July 9th at the Alaska Airlines Center in Anchorage. He'll be speaking in support of Governor Mike Dunleavy, who's running for re-election, as well as U.S. House candidate Sarah Palin and U.S. Senate candidate Kelly Chewbacca. Dunleavy faces several opponents in his bid for re-election, including Democrat Les Guerra and independent former Governor Bill Walker. 2 other prominent Republicans running against Dunleavy are Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor Charlie Pierce and Wasilla State Representative Christopher Kirka. Palin is running against Republican Nick Begich and Democrat Mary Peltola in the special election to fill the remainder of the late Congressman Don Young's term. Palin was an early supporter of Trump during his bid for the White House and has continued to support him. Meanwhile, Chewbacca is challenging incumbent Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski, as well as Democrat Pat Chesbro. Murkowski earned Trump's ire when she voted to impeach him for his role in the Capitol attack on January 6, 2021. Tickets to the rally in Anchorage are free. Trump is set to deliver remarks at 4 p.m. More than 7,500 ballots were rejected in the special U.S. House primary election, according to the final vote tally. That's a statewide rejection rate of about 4.5%, double the rejection rate from the 2020 primary. The final ballot rejection rate in rural Alaska communities was even higher, with about 1 in 8 ballots not being counted. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports on why ballots got rejected.
According to a report from the Division of Elections, the biggest reason for rejections in the state's first mail-in election was that the ballot didn't have a witness signature. That's the reason more than a third of rejected ballots did not get counted. State Division of Elections spokeswoman Tiffany Montemayor says while officials are concerned anytime they have to reject a ballot, they're bound by state law. In an email, Montemayor said, quote, "If there is not a voter signature, a voter identifier, a witness signature, and a postmark on or before Election Day, the ballot cannot count," unquote. Generally, rural Alaska communities off the road system that tend to be majority Alaska Native had the highest ballot rejection rates at around 13%. More than half of those rejections were because of a lack of witness signature. Within rural Alaska, the region covering Bethel and surrounding Yukon-Kuskokwim villages had the highest rejection rate in the state at around 17%, or 1 in 6 ballots. Almost 2/3 of rejections were due to a lack of witness signature. Bethel Mayor Mark Springer says he believes there wasn't enough outreach to residents in those communities, many of whom don't speak English as a first language.
You know, I mean, they ran a lot of ads, but the majority of the ones I heard were in English. They just said the special election is on such and such a date. Not heavy emphasis on, look, you got to do this right. Only vote for one and make sure you get a witness signature.
Montemayor said the Division of Elections spent more money on educational outreach in English and Alaska Native languages than any prior Alaska election. She said the division also did a live UPIC interview on Bethel Public Radio Station KYUK that emphasized ballot requirements, and it had a collaboration with UIT Communications to ensure the information given to Native corporations was accurate and the same as information given out in English. Montemayor said, quote, "For the first time in history, voters in communities designated as requiring language assistance were directly mailed translated information about the election and instructions on how to vote a by-mail ballot," unquote. The witness signature requirement on mail-in ballots has been a point of contention in Alaska, with opponents of the requirement calling it a bureaucratic roadblock. Montemayor says eliminating the witness signature would take legislative action, adding, quote, "It is also true that witness signatures may be any mark, and the division does not match witness or voter signatures against signatures it has on file," end quote. While the state doesn't have another mail-in election scheduled for the near future, Bethel Mayor Springer said the state has a lot of work to do before it conducts another one.
It's absolutely imperative that the Division of Elections, the Lieutenant Governor, learn some powerful lessons from the outcome of this, do some deep diving, do some root cause analysis, and make damn sure that the next time we have a mail-in ballot, we have nowhere near as many rejected ballots.
The remaining three elections this year, the general election to fill the rest of Young's term, and the regular primary and general elections, will be conducted through traditional means as opposed to by mail. Alaskans who vote absentee will still be required to get a witness signature. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
One of the nominees in the special U.S. House election is famous worldwide. Another bears the name of a former Alaska congressman and has a former U.S. senator for an uncle. Then there's Democrat Mary Peltola. Peltola was unknown by a majority of Alaskans as recently as May. She surprised a lot of political observers with a fourth-place finish in the June primary, high enough to put her name on the special general ballot. Peltola seems to have pulled herself out of statewide obscurity with one dominant personality trait, niceness. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
I think maybe a little closer to the podium so that we can get some photos.
Back in May, Peltola's campaign team erected a billboard with her face on it next to a lectern in an Anchorage park. They were set for a candidate meet and greet with balloons and streamers. But at the advertised start time, there was almost no one to greet, maybe five people. If Peltola considered it a bust, she didn't show it. She approached two undecided voters at a picnic table and cheerfully answered their every question.
I'm really glad you're here, and I do have a nuanced opinion on energy. I think a lot of rural Alaskans do.
Peltola, a former state legislator from Bethel, is 48 and undeniably nice. It's almost weird in the competitive environment of a campaign. Former Republican legislator Tom Anderson gushed praise for her when she appeared on his radio show June 22nd. He told his right-of-center audience he was happy when Peltola filed to run.
For her, and I thought, oh, good for her. Pat, pat on the head. Give me a hug. You're so sweet. You're so smart. You're not going to get in the top four, but I'm proud of you. I like you. Other people said that too. Well, she did.
Peltola says the people who raised her, both the UPIT and the Nebraskans, would be pleased to hear of her reputation.
The region where I'm from, there is a big premium on being respectful, on not using inflammatory language or harsh tones, not speaking to things that you haven't seen with your own eyes or heard with your own ears, you know, hearsay, not gossiping. I think that those are really good principles to live by.
Peltola was raised in Bethel and smaller Kuskokwim River communities. Her mom, Liz Ann Williams, is originally from Kwikluk. Her dad, Ward Sattler, was a bush pilot and educator. She has seven children, four of her own and three stepchildren with her husband, Gene Peltola. He's the top Alaska official in the Bureau of Indian Affairs. She was just 24 when, as Mary Sattler, she was elected to the Alaska legislature, beating incumbent Ivan in 1998.
I don't want to say anything harsh about Ivan, but at that time...
Peltola wanted stronger advocacy on rural education and the Bethel Seawall. In her decade in the legislature, she led the Bush Caucus, a group of rural legislators who could unite to achieve their priorities. Republican Rick Halford was president of the Senate during Peltola's decade in office. He says the Bush Caucus was a force to negotiate with.
You know, when you had something that somebody else had to have, there was usually something that the Bush had to have that got matched up with it and both got done.
Andrew Halcrow saw her in action in 1999 when he was a freshman Republican in the House and she was a freshman Democrat.
She was never bitter. She was never angry. She was never partisan. She just wanted to get, you know, really good policy done. And I think that that is her persona.
Halcrow roused anger early on with a floor speech about weaning rural Alaska off power cost equalization, a state program that helps offset high energy bills in remote communities. He likened the subsidy to putting children in Velcro shoes rather than teaching them to tie their laces. He says it was a mistake.
It's completely ignorant from a guy from Sand Lake to show up in Juneau and start lecturing on what rural Alaska needs or doesn't need.
Peltola might have been insulted and written him off. But within hours, Halcrow says she was at his office door asking if she could offer him a different perspective. Halcrow says she seemed to be investing in him, trying to educate the new generation of Republican legislators. Now, Halcrow sees power cost equalization as fairness, since the state spent hundreds of millions of dollars on power projects for urban Alaska.
I think with Mary Peltola, you should never, ever misconstrue kindness for somebody who's not going to stand up for what she believes in.
Peltola says she can be tough. She recalls a few screaming matches with other legislators. But she can also tell of small gestures that turned adversaries into political friends. She says friendship is more effective.
It's very easy for things to get personal and defensive and inflammatory really quickly. And then everything breaks down. In order to make the progress that we need in Alaska, in order to make the right decisions, we have to have a lower blood pressure. We have to respect all the people in the conversation at the table.
Rival candidate Sarah Palin took notice. Palin jumped in too soon at a recent candidate forum, launching into a question meant for Peltola. Peltola signaled to the moderator it was okay and touched the former governor on the shoulder to encourage her. Palin melted a little.
It doesn't matter. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, see how polite she is? This is the way it should be in politics.
Peltola smiled and shrugged, as though to say, think nothing of it. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Coming up, state health officials tell parents it's important to get young kids vaccinated.
Even though we know that it does not impact children to the same degree as our elders, we know that our children are not immune from this virus.
That's ahead on Alaska News Nightly. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's waters and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help stop aquatic hitchhikers by remembering to clean boots, boats, and trailer to remove plants, animals, and mud. Drain bilge, ballast, and buckets before leaving the area, and dry equipment before using it in a new body of water. Learn more at stopaquatichitchhikers.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Children under 5 years old began getting COVID vaccines in Alaska last week. In a health presentation to parents last night, state health officials stressed the importance of getting kids vaccinated and addressed common concerns. Alaska's chief medical officer, Dr. Ann Zink, said it's been a long time coming.
Some of you have had your children during this pandemic and have not had great ways to protect them from the worst of this disease. And even though we know that it does not impact children to the same degree as our elders, we know that our children are not immune from this virus.
The state reported a 26% increase in cases this week compared to the previous week. Case numbers among young children have been lower than older groups, but pediatrician Dr. Michelle Nace said it's still worth getting them vaccinated to reduce the likelihood of severe symptoms.
We want you to know that they're safe and they are effective. They are safe. Some people are concerned regarding how that might affect them. And we want you to know it doesn't change a person's DNA. It doesn't impact fertility. It has not been shown to have long-term impacts from the vaccination. And we know that there's secondary effects from getting COVID-19.
The two Alaskans under 19 who have died of COVID were both infants. There have also been more hospitalizations among kids younger than 10 than older kids. The risk for myocarditis, a type of heart inflammation, is higher from a COVID-19 infection than a vaccination. Health officials also emphasized how thorough the research was on pediatric vaccines before they were authorized. Dr. Lisa Rabinowitz said there were no cases of myocarditis, no allergic reactions, and no deaths during trials for the vaccines. Plus, she said the doses given to older groups have provided scientists with additional data.
The pediatric population is a protected population. So if you're wondering why this is coming so late in the game, we really take this population so seriously. So all the adults, all the older children, those trials happen first. We have the benefit of millions of doses to look at in terms of safety and efficacy before they started trials in this younger age group.
Pfizer has a 2-dose pediatric vaccine and Moderna has a 3-dose vaccine. Spacing between the doses varies depending on the brand. Rabinowitz said not all pediatricians and clinics will have both brands in stock, so parents should opt for whichever one is available from their provider. She said parents should talk to their pediatricians about any questions or concerns. The Aleutic Museum is one of six Alaska organizations set to receive a share of a $12.5 million grant from the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council. As KMXD's Kirsten Dobroth reports, it's the latest financial boost for coastal communities impacted by the 1989 spill.
The grant will be split between six organizations that are part of a collaboration called the Community Organized Restoration and Learning, or CORAL, Network. Molly Odell is the Director of Archaeology and Special Projects at the Aleutic Museum in Kodiak, which is a CORAL Network member. She says the funding will support 5 years of outreach and educational programming.
One of the main goals of the project is to do education and outreach related to resources that are affected by the spill in the spill-impacted region.
Aleutic history on the Kodiak Archipelago dates back to more than 7,000 years ago, and relics from Native villages and camps are found scattered across the island's coastline. But Odell says many of those sites were damaged from the 1989 spill.
Archaeological resources were impacted by the spill, both because some sites and artifacts were oiled and also because there was a lot of looting of archaeological sites during the cleanup.
Odell says properly handling archaeological resources became a part of training for volunteers later on in the cleanup effort. The museum has been the beneficiary of past funding from the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council, and Odell says the latest grant through the CORAL Network will help support the museum's existing archaeology program, including its summer internships.
We're providing training opportunities for interns to learn about archaeology, so they get to do field work and they get to see how the artifacts are cleaned and cataloged and stored in the museum.
Odell says the Aleutic Museum also has plans to print educational materials for community members about what to do if they stumble upon artifacts. She says the museum expects to receive its share of the funding after July 1st. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
A new regional center established by the Department of Defense in Anchorage will focus on Arctic security and connecting military and civilian stakeholders in the region. The Ted Stevens Center for Arctic Security Studies will operate at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. It's the sixth regional center established by DOD. The others are in Germany, Hawaii, and Washington, D.C. Senior Advisor for Arctic Security Affairs Major General Randy Church Key said on Talk of Alaska this week that other cities were considered for the new center, but Anchorage was ultimately chosen because of its location near the Arctic and other assets.
Anchorage actually is kind of a mini Washington, D.C. as far as the number of federal agencies are here. You also have a number of consulates here that represent nations who have Arctic interests. And then, of course, you have also the fact you have an Arctic Indigenous community, lots of headquarters here, for example, the Alaska Native Corporations, who have opportunity for you to connect not only with the Arctic Indigenous communities, but also Alaska Native communities for the industry part of the equation.
The Stevens Center, named for the late Alaska Senator Ted Stevens, They'll operate out of an existing building on JBEAR using a hub and network approach, hosting symposiums and engaging with stakeholders in and outside Alaska, including other Arctic nations. Key says research and analysis will help the Defense Department plan for future needs in the Arctic and will also help inform policy decisions. Craig Fleener is the deputy advisor for the Stevens Center. He says security studies extend beyond national defense. They plan to work with researchers, indigenous communities, environmental agencies, and the energy industry.
We'll travel to communities across the Arctic and invite people from communities to come here to participate. We know that this is a high priority area for the people of the Arctic, and so engagement and outreach is of significant importance to us.
Fleener says they hope to be a one-stop shop for research and collaboration in the Arctic. One of their mission areas includes addressing the impacts of climate change in the region.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
The United States Air Force has agreed to pay more than $200,000 in fines for mismanaging hazardous waste on a distant island in the Western Aleutians. The Environmental Protection Agency said in a statement last week the Air Force stored hazardous waste without a permit at Erickson Air Station on Shemya Island. Shemya is only about 500 miles from mainland Russia and about 1,500 miles west of Anchorage. The U.S. military began activities on Shemya during World War II. In the 1990s, the Air Force built a more modern station and has maintained a presence there since. The EPA says the Air Force improperly stored tons of toxic waste fuel and oil, hazardous paints, hydrochloric acid, and other chemicals, as well as waste items like batteries and aerosol cans. Ed Kowalski, a spokesperson for the EPA, said he's, quote, grateful that the Air Force has acknowledged its mistakes and stepped up its responsibilities to fix the problem. The Air Force agreed to pay nearly $207,000 in penalties, as well as to properly dispose of around 55,000 pounds of hazardous waste by the end of the month. Gold miners near Dawson uncovered an intact, mummified baby woolly mammoth last week, and experts are calling it one of the most significant paleontology finds in North America. The miners immediately contacted the local First Nation, the Trondekwechin. The specimen is now in the care of the Trondekwechin, who have named the mammoth Nunchoga. That means big baby animal in the Han language. Grant Zuzula is a paleontologist with the Yukon government.
This is the best woolly mammoth in North America ever discovered. It's the best woolly mammoth in the world outside of Russia. I started studying the Ice Age in Yukon in 1999, and this has been something that I've always dreamed of to see face to face. And this week, that dream really came true. We all met a baby woolly mammoth, Nunchoga, face-to-face the other day, and it's been overwhelming and exciting. And the fact that the miner called and reported this discovery is amazing. That's exactly what we want from gold miners when they find these amazing things that are out in the land of the Trondekwechin traditional territory. We want them to call and to report these discoveries, and he made the most important discovery in paleontology in North America. And the fact that the Trondekwechin were so instantly in love with her and excited to embrace what the teaching she's going to provide. It's been incredible. The last few days have been some of the most moving moments of my life. It's been incredible. I don't know how to process it all right now, to be honest with you. They're all laughing at me because I burst out crying. And when she was revealed, and we were all in a ceremony and praying, and the elders were leading us through this all. And it was very emotional for us all. We had scientists and Trondikwajin members, we had miners, and we had politicians all together in a circle. And it was one of the most emotional things you could imagine. It was incredible. And this is like not just a day for science. It's an incredible day for the Yukon. But I think most importantly, this is an important, incredible day for the Trondikwajin community. This is a new chapter in the history of Yukon mining and Yukon First Nation relationships. Will be going forward in a different way in terms of paleontology from now on. It's new. Everything is changing now because we have found something of such incredible, incredible importance.
That was Yukon government paleontologist Grant Zazula. Debbie Nagano is the director of heritage with the Trondikwajin.
It's quite important, I guess. And it's hard to fathom. You know, when they pull that tarp open and you've seen the new Cho'ga, it was breathtaking. And it was a long time. It could have been probably, chances are, about 4 minutes of silence of probably about close to 15 to 16 people around a circle. So it's the meaning. It's the meaning behind it, and it's very powerful. You know, one of the elders, which happened to be my mom, was she couldn't speak. You know, after we drove from the location, it she said this is going to be very powerful for our First Nations and for our people, and we have to carry ourselves that way. We have to respect it. And all along the way, we have to, because it means something. It came to us, and we have to figure out the meaning behind it, of why it came to us at this time. We did the ceremony. We blessed it. We went out to the location. We went out yesterday, and we brought an elder out, and she blessed the spot to make sure we were doing it in the right way. And the next steps for the Nucho Da, the baby mammoth, is we want to keep it here in the traditional territory of the Trondikwajin, and until we figure out what's the next steps. Again, it's a powerful thing to have, and you know, we want to have it here within, and then we'll go from there after that.
That was Debbie Nagano, director of heritage with the Trondikwajin, talking about the mummified baby woolly mammoth found in Canada's Yukon Territory last week. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early, Liz Ruskin, and Adeline Baxter in Anchorage, Kirsten Dobroth in Kodiak, Theo Greenlee in Unalaska, and Michael Pruhl in the Yukon. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby. Katie Anastas is our producer. And I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.